Today I'm going to talk about Ruth Bell Graham. And how many of y'all had a chance to watch Billy Graham's funeral or anything? Did y'all, anybody get a chance to watch that? Well, if you didn't, you can go. If you didn't, you can go to BillyGraham.org and watch his funeral. As a matter of fact, you could even go to Ruth Bell Graham's funeral. That was the first one I heard, which was such a blessing. But anyway, after Billy Graham died, I just kind of did some research on Ruth Bell Graham. And I really did not know that much about her. And actually, she played a very important part in his ministry. And I just thought it would be kind of neat. This is kind of laid back. I wanted to share with you some things that I have found out about her. And I hope that it will encourage you. And we can see what kind of woman she was and learn from her. But anyway, Ruth was a very passionate and ardent student of the scriptures. And it says that she had in her cabin, the log cabin, a study desk that had a big flat board, a big wide desk that she got to, a big flat board and made a table out of it. And it was stacked with commentaries and study Bibles. And she'd have her books out, and she would always keep notes and post-it notes and that kind of thing. She would run the journal. And she gained a lot of wisdom out of the Old Testament passages, and a lot of those passages really shaped her life. But there were three passages that I want to read to you today that really meant a lot to her, and it was read at her funeral. The first one is Psalms 90. And it says, Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you had formed the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. You return man to dust and say, return, O children of man, for 1,000 years in your sight are but as yesterday when it is past, or as a watch in the night. You sweep them away as with a flood. They are like a dream, like grass that is renewed in the morning. In the morning it flourishes and is renewed. In the evening it fades and withers. The years of our life are 70, or even by reason of strength, 80. Yet their span is but toil and trouble. They are soon gone away, and we fly away. So teach us to number our days, that we may get a heart of wisdom. Return, O Lord, how long? Have pity on your servants. Satisfy us in the morning with your steadfast love. And then Psalms 1 says, blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the wicked, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of scoffers. But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law he meditates day and night. He is like a tree planted by streams of water that yield its fruit in its season, and its leaf does not wither. And all that he does, he prospers. The wicked are not so, but are like chaff that the wind drives away. Therefore the wicked will not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. Psalms 23, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. And those were some passages that she really liked a lot. And as you can see in Psalms, it teaches us to number our days. And I thought about, you know, most of us in this room are living in the last quadrant of our lives. This is it. This, you know, we're all winding down. And, you know, I think about that quite a bit, you know, when you retire, like I just did. But I think about Ruth Graham and what a testimony she had. She was born in China on June 10th, 1920. And her sister says, like to say, we were both made in China. But anyway, her parents were medical missionaries. They were Presbyterian. And her father was a surgeon. And so Ruth lived there most of her childhood in China. And she had an older sister named Rosa. And they had a very happy childhood in spite of some of the things that they went through. During that particular time when they lived there, China was involved in a civil war. And so there was a lot of fighting and battles going on, and it was just not a safe place really to be. But and they used to call any of these missionaries that would come over there foreign devils. But anyway, Ruth was surrounded by a lot of wonderful Christian people. She said a lot of happy Christians, because there were other missionaries besides her parents. But one of the things that she says that she said, I cannot recall getting up in the morning, but what Daddy would be reading his Bible, or he would be praying on his knees, and he would see me and say, Ruth, have you read your Bible yet? And she said, frequently he would have to send me back to my room to begin the day as I should. Well, they ran a real tight ship at their house. And the Bell children, they were schooled in the strictest of manners. They would have to, when they came to dinner, they would have to dress up in their clothes, and they could not put their elbows on the table. And so they grew up in a very strict environment. Now, you have to remember, there was no TV, and so everything was done right there in their little community where they lived. Now, to little Ruth, God was an all-powerful Heavenly Father. And it's, her sister says that she had an unusual spirituality about her as a child. She was always seemed to be interested in the things of God. Her parents, or her mother, would teach the children in the home. They were homeschooled for a while, in her mother's bedroom. And they would have lessons in hygiene and learn how to spell and do math and read, and they would learn geography, and it says that they would have to use secondhand textbooks, and even some of the National Geographic magazines that people would send over there to them, they would use all those things. But after a while, the father, Dr. Bell, decided it was time that his children be exposed to some more advanced schooling. And so this is where a lady named Lucy Fletcher, she was a young school teacher hired by the Foreign Mission Board to go to China and to teach Ruth along with some other missionary children. So Lucy Fletcher came along, and at first Ruth did not like her. She did not, I guess she was strict or something. She just didn't care for her. She lived in their two-story house above Ruth's bedroom. But Ruth grew to like her, and she realized after all she wasn't so bad after all. But she was a skilled Bible teacher, and she inspired a love of and a respect for Scripture. And the books that I'm reading says that her methods were very rigorous, and she would require the children, for example, to memorize all 50 chapters of Genesis. Can you imagine that? And she'd offer anybody that can say all 50 chapters perfectly, she would give them $5. And Ruth got $4.50 because she didn't memorize all 50. She memorized only 3. So I thought that was pretty good considering. But after a while, when she was 13 years old, it was time to start high school. Well, there was no high school in China during that time. And so the parents had to make a decision where they were going to send Rosa and Ruth. And they decided on a school in North Korea, where Kim Jong-un lives right now. You can imagine, in that capital. And so they picked that school because they realized it was a good school, and it had a lot of, I don't know if it had any Christian teaching there, but in doing their research, they felt like that was the one that they needed to go to. Well, Ruth didn't want to go. She didn't want to leave China. She didn't want to leave all of her Chinese friends. She didn't want to leave her parents. She didn't want to leave her home. But that was just something she had to do. So they put her on a boat. Her sister was already over there. And she heads over to North Korea. She says in her book that this was considered her boot camp. This is where God trained her as a 13-year-old girl. And she was very homesick. She could make it through the day, but at nighttime she would cry herself to sleep every night. It was just unbearable. And she would beg them, and she'd beg her parents, please let me go back home. I just don't like this place. And one of the times when she was over there, she got sick. And she had to spend several days in the infirmary. And one day when she was there, she used that entire day to read the Psalms, all 150 of the Psalms. And it was in her reading those Psalms, God used that to strengthen her and to encourage her in His Word. But it was also during this time in Korea that she began to learn to write. She loved to write, and she wrote a lot of poetry. And she would use that to express herself and to just, you know, the sadness that she was going through, she used that as an outlet to help her express herself and her emotions. And so I never realized this about Ruth Belgren, but she was, as a matter of fact, she wrote this book, Ruth Belgren Collected Poems. They're amazing. And it says that if you really want to know Ruth Bell Graham, you should read her poems because they speak a lot about her. And they're really phenomenal. This whole book is full of them. And she's even got more than this. But it was during that time that she learned to write. Also during this time, she realized, well, looking back over her life, she said, now I can see the loneliness that I went through and the times of depression that I went through. Those were difficult times, but now I'm grateful for them because I can see how God used that period in my life to where I am today. Because you have to remember, Ruth Bell Graham was alone most of the time. They said that Billy Graham, when he traveled, he was out 6 months of the year. So she was alone by herself. Well, it was during that time when she was in Korea that she began to have a crisis of faith. And she thought, you know, I've grown up and I've heard all about Jesus Christ my whole life, and I really cannot depend on my family's salvation for my own. So she began to doubt. And she began to doubt her faith. And it says during that time she doesn't understand exactly why. Maybe it was unanswered prayers. You know, she was praying God would get her out of that place, and He didn't do it. And she begged Him, and she just didn't know. But she had a hard time during that time. And she went to her sister Rosa and said, listen, I don't know what's going on with me, but I'm just really having some doubts right now. And her sister Rosa said, well, Ruth, what you need to do is you need to open your Bible, and you need to open it up, and you need to start reading, and you put your own name in some of those. Make it personal. Put your own name in the Bible. Have any of you ever done that before, you know, where you can read the Psalms and you can insert your name? It makes it more personal. And that's exactly what she did. She took her sister's advice, and she went back and she picked up Isaiah 53. And she did what her sister told her, you know, where it says, He was wounded for Ruth's transgressions. He was buried for Ruth's iniquities. The chastisement of Ruth's peace was upon him, and with his stripes, Ruth is healed. Well, God used that to settle that issue of her assurance of her salvation. And she said she knew then that I was included and that God had saved me. But from that time on, her personal faith grew ever stronger. Well, another thing about Ruth is that living in China, she grew to love the Chinese people. But yet she also saw some of the heartaches and the paganness of the way they lived. And so she had a strong desire to be a Christian missionary. She said, that's what I want to be when I grow up. When I grow up, I know what I want to do. I know what I want to do with my life. I want to be a missionary. I never want to get married. And I'm going to spend the rest of my life as a missionary in Tibet. And that was her goal. Well, it was just about this time that the war was going on. And sometimes when it really got heated up over there, the embassy would tell the Christian missionaries who lived in America, you need to go back home. And so they would. They would get on their ship and they would sail home. Well, Ruth's father and the mother were preparing to go home, and they said, you know, Ruth, you need to go to college. You're 17 years old now, and you need to go to college. Well, why do I need to go to college to be a missionary? You know? And they said, well, this is what you need to do. You need to get your education. So she relented. And so she gets on the USS McKinley. How many of you know President McKinley? Raise your hand. Anybody? Okay. You remember him? Mm-hmm. President McKinley? So anyway, she gets on the USS McKinley.
Yeah.
And while she was there, I mean, it took quite a while for them to get to America. But she took out her journal, she took out her writing, she started writing, and she wrote, she made a list, it says, of, and this is what I want to read to you. She said, I found myself making up a list, and this is what she wrote down. If I marry, he must be so tall when he is on his knees, as one has said, he reaches all the way to heaven. His shoulders must be broad enough to bear the burden of a family. His lips must be strong enough to smile, firm enough to say no, and tender enough to kiss. His love must be so deep that it takes its stand in Christ, and so wide that it takes in the whole world. He must be big enough to be gentle and great enough to be thoughtful. His arms must be strong enough to carry a little child. That's kind of an odd list for someone who decided that she would never get married, but she wrote that down. And then fast forward, you see who she married.
Yeah, well, this is a description.
But anyway, she goes to school, college, and she ends up going to Wheaton College in Illinois, in Chicago, Illinois. And it says that she showed up dressed in hand-me-down clothes and 5'7" saddle shoes. And they said that she was such a pretty girl. And a lot of the upperclassmen thought she was just beautiful. And of course, she was a sweet Christian girl also. And so a lot of the upperclassmen would compete for her attention. It says her sister Rosa wrote down one time, you know, my sister has 52 boyfriends and I only have two. But anyway, they would ask her out, and she'd go out. And back in those days, you know, they'd go to the ice cream parlor shop, you know, that kind of thing. Nothing really, you know, wild or anything. But she'd go out with them. But little did she know, there was a 10:30 curfew that she had to be back. Well, now, the story goes, when she lived in China, you know, there was nothing really to learn as far as rules not to do certain things. And so she didn't think a thing about it. You know, okay, it would get back at 10:30. So she would just crawl in the window of the dorm when she was late. Well, she did this a couple of times and finally got in trouble about it. And her house mother let her have it and told her, you know, you are ignoring these rules that are written down in this student handbook, and you've got a pile of rules in there that you need to go back and read. And she says the handbook was a compilation of regulations outlining dozens of petty sins. But I thought there were only the original Big Ten. That was enough. So she was, you saw that. So anyway, they shamed her and said, you're going to disgrace yourself, you're going to disgrace this school, you're going to disgrace your parents. And so they grounded her. And they said, you cannot have any more dates, You're not allowed to leave this school grounds. And so what did she do during that time? She wrote. She wrote, continued to write. Well, finally, after a while, the Wheaton faculty realized that Ruth's infractions were committed out of ignorance, not wickedness, and so they lifted her sentence. Well, it was soon after that that the word got around that there was a new student on the campus whose name was Billy Frank. And he was a new transfer student from Florida, Tampa, Florida. He went to Florida Bible College or something like that. And the word got around that he was new and that he was a gifted preacher. And he was also a young man on whose shoulder God's hand seemed to rest. He had a distinctive voice and a passion for souls. Well, a friend wanted to introduce Billy Graham to Ruth. And they did, and Billy Graham later on said, "I fell in love the minute I saw her." The minute he saw her, but he never told her that. And so it was shortly after that that he asked her out for their first date. And they went to a Sunday afternoon presentation of the Messiah. Well, they really didn't get to know each other on that first day because they sat there and listened to that. But Ruth goes on to say she knew on that first date they went out that he was the one for her. There was something she says about him. She knew he was the one. So she said, I brought it before the Lord, and I left it there. Well, Billy Graham, at first, he hid his feelings also. You remember, he had his eyes focused on what God wanted him to do, was to preach the word and to win souls. And she was thinking she wanted to be a missionary in Tibet. So, but anyway, he hid his feelings. She never really knew where he stood with her, and I think vice versa. And she didn't think that he was very interested in her. But Ruth says that Billy was unlike anyone she had ever met. So, and so Ruth wrote at the time, this is what she wrote. She said, Bill, and she called him Bill. She said, he's six foot two. Who ever heard of calling somebody Billy? So she would call him Bill. So she says, Bill is a real inspiration because I suppose he is a man of one purpose, and that one purpose controls his whole heart and life. He is dead in earnest, yet richly endowed with the fruit of the Spirit, humble, thoughtful, unpretentious, and courteous. And so she was really, you know, liking him a lot. Well, she still thought about, their relationship grew, and they would go out, and one night she came home, and she knelt beside her bed, and she prayed, God, if you let me serve you with that man, I'd consider it the greatest privilege in my life. But still there was Tibet. Still, what about that burning desire to be a missionary? So she would go to him and try to suggest to him that maybe, and persuade him, maybe, you know, we can go over to Tibet and you can preach the gospel over there. But he didn't. Weeks passed and he didn't have anything to say about that. Well, finally, Billy said, Ruth, do you believe God has brought us together? She said, yes. And he said, in that case, God will lead me and you will do the following. And she said, and I have ever since. So the fast forward, there's a lot more we could go into. Fast forward, they got married in 1943. And his first job was a pastor of a church. And that was only for a short time. But anyway, Billy Graham got called into evangelism. That's a whole other story. It's fascinating to see how that all came about and how God just blessed his ministry as an evangelist. But they moved, her parents had moved back to Montreat, North Carolina, and that's where they moved. Because Billy had begun to leave and go on some of these crusades, and she thought it would be kind of nice just to be close to her parents. Well, it was because she had five children. They had five children. And she had to raise those five children while he was away. Well, as Billy Graham started getting to be more famous, a household word, that they couldn't do anything without people bothering them, and people would just try to come up to the house and go slow about, you know, try to even look in their windows and all this kind of stuff, you know. And so they knew they were going to have to do something for their privacy. And so they went up the mountain and they found this area, this cove, they call it a cove, that that was just beautiful. It overlooked the mountains and everything. And someone had offered them this piece of land and at a real good price. I think it was like $4,500 for this land back in those days. And so they loved it. So Billy says to her, well, I tell you what, I've got to go to California for a crusade. And I want you to think about it, and whatever you decide, we'll do. Well, he comes back, and in the meantime, she went to the bank and borrowed money and came back and said, I bought the code. So that's it. So, the book tells about this log cabin that they lived in. She would scrape around all those log cabins in North Carolina and get some of the old wood and bricks, and, you know, she got all of this stuff. She was also very artistic, and she had that flair, you know, she liked to draw, but she kind of planned what she wanted the house to be, a real simple place, which they lived in the rest of it. They were married for 64 years, and that's where they lived their entire life. A very modest home, but it was something that they enjoyed, and they called it Little Piney Cove. That's what it was known as. But it protected them from some of the tourists, because they had gates around and they had their privacy. And they entertained a lot when they were married. They had a lot of presidents go up there and live, visit. They would, and not only that, in reading this about Ruth Graham, she was never real impressed by being around who's who or whatever. That was not something that, she was not a pretentious person whatsoever. As a matter of fact, they said that she loved entertaining drug addicts, kids from the juvenile delinquent home. They said if you were to read, if she had a guest book and everybody had to sign the guest book, you would see a long list of all these criminals and everything else. But those were the people that she liked. She wanted to minister to them. And she would have them over at her house to eat just like she'd have President Nixon or whoever. And she felt like that's what God wanted her to do. Well, one of the things that Ruth realized, that since Billy was away, her number one ministry was her children. And this book right here, this is interesting. And that was not an easy job for her. And of course, you know, God always uses different things in our lives to make us more like Him and to make us more dependent on Him. And for her, it was raising those five children by herself while He was away. Her father helped be the man figure in their life while He was away. But most of the time, it was Ruth. But anyway, she was writing in her journal, and she titled it Help. And she said she was reading Exodus 33. And I wanted to turn there and go to Exodus chapter 33. And God used this to really speak to her. You know, anytime they said that if you were to go to her house, she was very disorganized. And if you went to her house, you saw notes everywhere. Post-it notes, notes here, open books here where she didn't finish the book, you know, that kind of thing. But she went to Exodus, and God really used this passage here in Exodus to teach her. Exodus chapter 33, beginning with verse 12, where Moses said to the Lord, see, you say to me, bring up this people, but you have not let me know whom you will send with me. Yet you have said, I know you by name, and you have also found favor in my sight. Now, therefore, if I have found favor in your sight, please show me now your ways, that I may know you in order to find favor in your sight. And the thing that really stuck out to Ruth in this passage was, show me your ways. you know, Moses had these people, but she had her children. And she was asking God to show me what to do because I'm here and I don't know what to do. And she says, after reading Exodus, she said, this job of training five little grands to be good soldiers of Jesus Christ is too big for me, who am not a good soldier myself. Feeling particularly distracted, or should I say overwhelmed and confused, I have been looking to the Lord, asking where from here. Bill will be leaving soon for the San Francisco meeting, and I almost have a sinking feeling. Not altogether a left behind and left out sort of feeling, but swamped, knowing that all the things I have depended on others to do, I shall have to do by myself. And things have not been going smoothly. There is a terrible amount of fighting among the children, ugliness and back talk from Gigi, and peevishness on my part, backed by sporadic, uncertain discipline. I am not walking the Lord's way at all. You see how transparent she is? I am doing what I feel like doing rather than what I ought to do. Self-indulgence is doing what we want rather than what we ought. And she says, and I don't look well to the ways of my household. Children well taught, even to brushing teeth and keeping rooms straight. Regular family prayers at supper table. Children's clothes kept mended and neat and organized. Getting ready for Sunday on Saturday, well, there's no use going into it all. It just boils down to the fact that I am not being a good mother. So I took it to him this morning. I want above everything to be the kind of person he wants. If he had had his undisputed way in me, I would be. Everything would solve itself. The place to begin is here. The time is to begin is now. And as I reread Exodus chapter 33, the phrase that jumped out at me, which I had never noticed before, was, show me now thy ways. And that's exactly what she did. You know, you can imagine what it would be like to raise five small children by yourself in a mountain home with your husband away all the time. But then the funny thing part is, this one is called Dog Training. And she wrote this in her journal, and she said, we'll have to give this to Lindsay. Every parent should at least have one good book on dog training. Odd how, in a day when children are notoriously disobedient, dog training and obedience classes are increasing in popularity. Basically, the rules are simple. Number one, think about this if you're training a dog, and you can think about raising children. Number one, keep commands simple and at a minimum. Our word to a command, and always the same word. Come, sit, stay, heel, down. No. Number two, be consistent. Number three, be persistent and follow through. Never give a command without seeing it is obeyed. Number four, when the dog responds correctly, praise him. Not with food. Remember, don't reward children materially for doing well. Your praise should be enough. And that was what she used, that simple little easy thing right there to help her in raising her kids. But I thought that was just a cute little thing there in raising her children. We'll have to give that to her. but anyway, you know, I don't know if some of you know this, but all of her children, all five of the children, did not live perfect lives. And I don't know if some of you may know that. About three of her children strayed away from the Lord or lived very rebellious lives. And it was very heartbreaking. But she said she learned to love them in spite of it all. And she has a book on the prodigal son or something like that. But it was so wonderful to see at her funeral, all of those children, all five of the grown children, had many wonderful things to say about her at the funeral. Mm-hmm. And I started writing down a list of some of the things. And this is a wonderful tribute to her, because here she was in this book feeling so inadequate. and feeling like she was blowing it all and she wasn't doing a good job and overwhelmed. But they all had something so precious to say about her, and they described her as being caring, and I wrote some of these words down, sensitive, she loved the Bible, she was always fun. She had an adventurous spirit, she was a feisty little woman. She was unselfish, she was always thinking of others, giving, and one of her sons says she modeled true righteousness. And she had a total confidence of who she was in God. Not a respecter of persons, godly example, and very unjudgmental. But the books, if you were to read the books, it tells you about all the crazy things. I was reading it to William and Brian. They said, she sounds like she's crazy. You know, they had a bunch, I'll tell you the whole story. There was a bunch of rattlesnakes and copperheads on that property. And Franklin Graham said there was one summer they killed about 70 snakes.
Wow.
Well, that didn't bother Ruth at all. If she saw a snake, she'd go and get the pitchfork that they roasted the marshmallows on it and go chase them. And he tells a story about that. She'd go down the mountain trying to stab that snake, and he turned his head and she tried to stab. But she was always doing crazy things like that. And one time she got on top of the roof because Franklin locked his door, and she was mad at him because he wouldn't open that door. So she gets up on the roof and crawls up the roof, and he sees her and locks the door. I mean, she was always doing crazy things. But she was someone that they all respected and they loved. But another thing that Ruth felt like she wanted to, needed to do in her calling life was to be the wife to Billy Graham. And I just want to read you something here that he said, what Billy Graham said as far as his wife was concerned. Somebody, he says, without Ruth's partnership and encouragement over the years, my own work would have been impossible. We were called by God as a team. And after her children were grown, she did travel with them quite a bit. And she was an encouragement to them. They said that she helped write a lot of his books, even that Peace with God. She had her stamp in there. But anyway, Billy says, she urged me to go, saying, God has given you the gift of an evangelist. I'll back you. I'll rear the children, and you travel and preach. And I have been asked the question, who do you go to for counsel, for spiritual guidance? My answer, my wife, Ruth. She is the only one I completely confide in. She is a great student of the Bible. Her life is ruled by the Bible more than any person I've ever known. That's her rule book, her compass. Her disposition is the same all the time, very sweet and very gracious and very charming. When it comes to spiritual things, my wife has had the greatest influence on my ministry. She was his number one advisor and critic. She was his companion and his friend. There was a story that says they went to visit Lyndon Johnson in the White House, and they were sitting at lunch. And Lyndon Johnson looks over at Billy Graham and says, who do you think I ought to pick for my running mate for vice president? And Ruth, the story says Ruth got her foot and kicked Billy Graham in the leg. And they go, what was that all about? She said, your job is to offer spiritual and moral advice. And you are not to get into politics. And later on, Lyndon Johnson said, you're right. I'm glad you said that. Because that was one thing they never wanted to get into, was politics. And the son of the story says she kept him straight on that a lot. But one interesting thing about Ruth that I saw is she was visiting her daughter in Wisconsin. One of her children had six children, so she had six grandchildren by the oldest child, Gigi. And like I said, she was a fun grandmother, and so she decided that she wanted to rig up a pipe slide for the children, where she would get a wire and she'd put it through this 8-inch pipe. And you go to a tree and you hang it up there, and then you fasten it to another tree, and they could go up there and then slide
down.
You know, of course, they thought that would be fun. Well, she wanted to try it out before she let the kids do it. So she climbs up that tree and tries it out, and the wire snaps, and she falls 15 feet. And when she hit the ground, she was knocked out. They thought she was just faking it, you know, because she was always doing crazy things, until the dog came and looked her on the face, and she didn't move, so they knew something was wrong. So they called 911, and they rushed her to the hospital. And when she got there, there was no pulse. Right at first, the doctors couldn't find a pulse. But come to find out, she had crushed a vertebrae. She had broken a rib. She had had a severe brain concussion. Her left heel was split in five different places. And she was in a coma for a week. Her progress was very slow. And when she finally came to, she couldn't remember a lot of things. And she was saying, "Oh Lord, please don't let me forget those Bible verses that I've learned all my life. You know, please don't take that away from me." And sure enough, God did give her that back. But the doctor said ever since then, she suffered from a short-term memory loss because of that fall. Well, that bad of a fall left her whole left side very weak. And eventually she had to have her hip replaced. But she also acquired, she had degenerative arthritis in her neck and in her back. And they thought that it would be good to implant a morphine pump to help her with the pain because it was so bad. And they believed that procedure was, they believed when they opened her up that exposed her to bacterial spinal meningitis, which she got, and they didn't think she was going to live. So, you know, she didn't live this glamorous life that you would think Billy Graham's wife. I mean, she had the children, she had different things, and then she had these health problems that she dealt with. Because at the time that she had this bad fall, she was, I think, in her 50s, and she died at 87, so all during that time, she struggled with physical problems. And it says that she died June 7th, 2007. That was about 11 years ago. She was bedridden, and she finally died from pneumonia. But both of them died in their home up there. And I don't know if y'all realize this, but both of them were buried in a simple plywood pine box. Did y'all hear the story about that? How the plywood casket that she was buried in was made by a convicted murderer who had been born again in prison and who died of cancer back in March of the same year. And now the story goes, right now they are together with all of the saints rejoicing. But it was just a simple simple funeral and a simple casket. But that is Ruth Bell Graham. She, you know, if you ever get a chance, let's see, who might be responding to this? Oh, another one I want to share. If y'all have not gotten this book, this would be a good book to get. This was the last book that Billy Graham wrote. He was 93 years old when he wrote this book. This was after she had died. My mother died at 89, and one of her friends said, "Cecile, you have got to go get this book by Billy Graham, because it has blessed my heart and you will love it." So the summer that I was in Mobile before she died in September, we went to the bookstore and I got it for her, and she was not a reader, but she read this book, and I remember quoting something. I saw where she underlined some things, and I read some of the things that she had underlined. But it's a very good book, and I just love what Billy Graham, after his funeral, what he has to say. He said, "I never thought I would live to be this old." This is when he was 93, he died at 99. He says, "All my life I was taught how to die as a Christian, but no one ever taught me how I ought to live in the years before I die. I wish they had, because I'm an old man now, and believe me, it's not easy." whoever first said it was wise. Old age is not the sissies. Get any group of older people together, and I can almost guarantee what their favorite topic of conversation will be. Their latest aches and pains. I will soon celebrate my 93rd birthday, and I know it won't be long before God calls me home to heaven. More than ever, I look forward to that day, not just because of the wonders I know heaven holds in store for me and for every believer, but because I know that finally all the burdens and sorrows that press down upon me at this stage of my life will be over. During the last year, the physical ailments common to old age really have taken their toll on me. I also look forward to that day because I will be reunited with Ruth, my beloved wife and best friend for almost 64 years, who went home in 2007 to be with the Lord she loved and served so faithfully. Although I rejoice that her struggles with weakness and pain have all come to an end, I still feel as if a part of me has been ripped out, and I miss her far more than I could ever have imagined. So, that is the story of Ruth Bell Graham. Now, what I wanted to pass out is someone also said, or one of her sons was given that Valley of Vision book. And her mother was given that book also. And one of her favorite prayers in that book was one called Sleep. And the story is that Billy Graham loved somebody. You know, he lost his eyesight too. He would love for somebody to read this poem. So I went ahead and printed it because I thought, gosh, I need to read this. I need to keep this. I'm going to stop and keep this. This is a beautiful prayer. You can take it home later and read it tonight. But if you've never had the chance to do some reading on her, it will bless your heart. In closing, I just have to read this. She wrote a poem called Time to Adore. And it was a poem that she wrote, What It Will Be Like When I Die. And this is what she wrote. And when I die, I hope my soul ascends slowly so that I may watch the earth receding out of sight, its vastness growing smaller as I rise, savoring its recession with delight. Anticipating joy is itself a joy. And joy unspeakable and full of glory needs more than in the twinkling of an eye. More than in a moment. Lord, who am I to disagree? It's only we have much to leave behind, so much before. These moments of transition will, for me, be time to adore. So.